Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. The sun is yellow, Sirius is blue, and good grief, the sky is too. I like listening to the voice of the universe, Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Comet Watch. Yes, it is the August show. We are here again, so I'll introduce myself. I'm Nicky Vetz, and my co-host is...
Neil Norman.
And we've got a packed show for you, and we have a special guest this month. Appreciate that you getting our special guest on board, Neil. Top marks there, mate.
So, no worries.
As usual, we will start with the latest discoveries, courtesy of the BAA comic section. So I'll kick it off. July 12th, Bozu reports a non-group comet in real-time C2 images.
And again on July the 12th, Bozu reports a non-group comet in real-time C3 images.
July 15th, discovery of 2015 M2 P4 pan stars announced.
Also on July the 15th was the discovery of 2015 M3 pan stars announced.
On July 16th, Bozu reports a Kreutz group comet in real-time C3 images.
July the 21st was the discovery of 2015 01 pan stars.
July 24th, Zijian Zhu reports a Kreutz group comet in real-time C3 images.
On August the 2nd, Bozu reports a Kreutz group comet in real-time C3 images.
August the 3rd, Masanori Nishina reports a Kreutz group comet in real-time C3 images.
On August the 4th, Warshot Boomplod reports a Maya group comet in real-time C2 images.
Okay, and July 10th, recovery of 2007 V2, P/Hill, 2015 P1 reported.
On August the 10th, Mikhail Biziada reports a Maya group comet in real-time C2 images.
On August the 11th, recovery of 2002 Q1, P. Van Ness, as 2015 P2 reported.
And on August the 11th also, the exciting discovery of 2015 P3 Swan by Michael Matiazzo was reported.
And that's the update for latest discoveries. And as usual, I know we've been compared to the shipping forecast on BBC Radio 4, so I am kind of pleased about that one, aren't you, Neil?
So, I am, yes.
So here's the current comet magnitudes as of August the 11th, and observable region August 2nd. I'll kick off with Catalina 2013 US 10, magnitude 7, trending bright, 15 degrees north to 90 degrees south, visible all night, last visually observed 2015 August.
Next is the rather exciting comet Pan-STARRS 2014 Q1, which is fading currently at magnitude 8.5. 10 degrees north to 90 degrees south, best viewed in the evening and was last viewed in August.
And then followed by Lovejoy 2014 Q2, the magnitude 9.5 is fading, 55 degrees north to 15 degrees south. It's an all-night object, last observed August.
Next is Comet Jax 2015 F4, which I was lucky enough to view earlier this week. Magnitude 10.5 and it's steady, 55 degrees north to 40 degrees south, easily located all night. And was last seen in July 2015.
19P Borelli, 11 magnitude, that's got a question mark against it at the moment. It's fading, poor elongation, and has not been yet observed from the United Kingdom.
Next up is 88P Howell, 11.5 magnitude, but fading, 55 degrees north to 55 degrees south, best viewed in the morning, and last seen in August.
Then we have Master 2015 G2. Currently 11.5, it's fading, it's in conjunction, and it was last observed June of this year.
Next we have 22P Koff, magnitude 12, and it's steady, 35 degrees north to 65 degrees south, best viewed in the evening, and last observed in August.
Swan 2015 P3, 12.5 magnitude, beginning to fade, 15 degrees north to 35 degrees south, it's an early evening object, not yet observed from the UK.
Next is Spacewatch 2011 K36, magnitude 12.5, question marked, but brightening, 55 degrees north to 60 degrees south, best viewed in the morning, but is yet to be observed.
And of course, my favourite, 29 P. Schwachmann Wachmann, 13 magnitude question mark, varies. 35 degrees north to 90 degrees south, best in the evening, and last observed July 2015.
Next we have Pan-STARRS 2012 F3, question marked at magnitude 13.5, 50 degrees north to 70 degrees south, an evening object, and last seen in May of 2014.
Again, Pan-STARRS 2012 K1, 13.5 magnitude question mark, fading, 30 degrees north to 75 degrees south, best in the morning, and last observed in the UK in January 2015.
Next is the periodic comet 10P Temple, magnitude 14 question mark, should be brightening, 45 degrees north to 70 degrees south, best viewed in the evening and is yet to be observed.
And finally, but not least, Tangara 2013 C2, 14 magnitude, outburst. So if you've got, if you can see it, do image it, please. Do send your observations to the BAA, and I'm sure there's quite a few other organisations that would love to get your images and sketches. 10 degrees north to 80 degrees south. It's an evening object, and it was last visibly observed in the UK in March 2015. And that actually completes the comet magnitude roundups. And now I'm going to call our special guest in. So just bear me for 1 second, folks. We now have a special guest on the show, so I'm actually going to ask our special guest to introduce himself.
Okay, I'm Rodney Austin. I live in New Plymouth, New Zealand, and I've been comet hunting off and on since about 1967 or thereabouts. I have three comets in that time, which made me one of the more successful discoverers in the 1980s, but I haven't been successful since.
Could you tell us a little bit how you actually do your comet hunting?
Well, I have three telescopes that I've used over the time. Two of them were made with the same 6-inch F8 refractor lens, which is a Jager's lens I got in from the United States. The first telescope was a typical straight-through telescope, and the second one, I folded it up with a couple of optical flats, and I looked in through the side. It looked a bit like a Newtonian, actually, because it's out as mounting, it rotates around the eyepiece. And when you're scanning in altitude, and then of course I just push backwards and forwards to go in azimuth. So it's simply a case of scanning the sky and overlapping strips carefully, and noting anything unusual in the way of a fuzzy object, and comparing them with the charts. And that basically, as I said, if something's there that shouldn't ought to be there, then there's a possibility you've got a comet, and if you're really lucky, it's a new one.
Could you tell us how you got interested in comets and astronomy in general?
It goes back a very long way. My grandmother was actually interested in comets and used to get her children up to look at any bright comet that was around. And my mother carried on the tradition, and I got to see my very first comet at the age of 3, and back in 1948. But it didn't really impinge on me until about 1956, when I got really interested in astronomy as a result of observing a solar eclipse. And from that time on, I've been hooked.
I see that you've got three discoveries. Your first one was in 1982. How did you discover it?
Well, like any discovery, I suppose, in a sense, by accident. The original 6-inch refractor was on a pretty hairy set of mounting, and I was working night shifts at the local newspaper. I went up country after work. Wasn't a particularly good night, but I started scanning the southeastern sky, and because of the mounting design, it didn't make it very easy to scan an azimuth, so I simply scanned an altitude, and on one of the scans upwards, I came across a fuzzy blob that I didn't recognise, and compared with the charts, I didn't have the charts with me that gave me the really relevant information, so, and as the wind was getting up, I packed up, went home, dug out the charts from a box at the bottom of a pile of boxes, and at 4 in the morning I suddenly realised I had a real new comet on my hands. It got a bit exciting from that point on.
Go on, Neil.
I was going to say, Rodney, Hi, Rodney. Right. I was just going to say, I've noticed from looking at the research earlier on that the comet of 1982 and the one you discovered, the comet 1984 N1, they were discovered pretty close to each other, weren't they? Do you have at that time, were you looking in a certain area all the time? You know, because you got lucky there the first time you...
No, it's a sheer coincidence. There's the third one was found only about 25 degrees away in the sky. It's just one of those lucky coincidences, I suppose. Since the first two comets were found in June 82 and July 84, that area of the sky, it was the best part to observe in the morning sky. I search only the morning sky. I don't do the evening sky at all. So mainly that's because of my working hours, but there are good sound reasons for observing the morning sky rather than the evening sky.
And, of course, I've got to ask you about your last discovery, which was touted by many to be a great comet, wasn't it? The C-1989-X1, now designated.
Yes.
A lot of people were hoping for a very... That did, didn't it? Because I think it only got to about 3.5 magnitude at best, didn't it? And a lot of people were thinking it was going to be a very lovely object.
Yes, well, the problem with comets, of course, is like David Levy says, they have tails. They're just like cats, they have tails, and they do exactly as they please. And in this particular case, the comet was a very gassy comet. It was very little dust. And it's the dust that reflects sunlight and the wavelengths that we can see, whereas a gassy comet tends to broadcast its light more in the blue-green area of the spectrum, which is the human eye is not particularly sensitive to. And so this was one of the gassiest comets around. And so, of course, it just simply didn't live up to some quite grandiose predictions, a bit like Comet Quixote, I guess. So it was embarrassing.
Now, a quick question. Are all your instruments, I get the feeling from reading what the research about you, all your instruments are homemade, is that correct?
Essentially, yes. Professional optics, although the telescope I used for my last discovery is actually a commercial instrument, a Meade 8-inch Schmidt Newtonian with a 2x Barlow on it and a 2-inch focus eyepiece. So it's actually quite low powered. I have a photograph of it on my Facebook page.
Yes.
But that's the one I use these days.
Yeah, Neil sent me some of the pictures showing your telescopes, and they're it's quite impressive. I really like the Dobbs. I'm looking at the 8-inch that you used for 1989 X1. That's a very interesting setup. How did you come to set the scope up in that manner?
Mainly it's because I've got a bad neck, and it's actually easier if you can look straight into an eyepiece at the same altitude. So the altitude of the eyepiece never changes. So when you change the telescope in altitude, it's simply rotating around the final optical axis. And so the eyepiece is always at the same height. So I just stood at the telescope. I actually used the eyepiece system as the drawing handle, effectively. So I pushed it backwards and forwards in azimuth, holding onto the eyepiece, and just tap the telescope in an altitude and go to a new field, and back we go again. So it just scans completely in overlapping strips. So it evolved from the second version of the 6-inch refractor, which did exactly the same thing, although it was a mighty beast to use, and finally wrecked my back when I was lifting it off the mounting one night. So I had a much lighter telescope, he says. So it's a matter
of course, we must remember.
Really.
Yeah, I was going to say, we must remember that also Bill Bradfield built his own telescope. I mean, there's a great thing on YouTube if anybody wants to look it up, and it shows Bill Bradfield and the telescope he used to find his comets. He discovered 18, and it was unbelievable. He was a New Zealander. A lot of people think he was Australian, but he was a New Zealander, so we get that bit right. But it was absolutely fantastic, the setup. Yeah, so it's absolutely amazing.
He was an interesting guy. He was born about 4 hours drive from where I live, but he moved to Australia in 1947, so he would have been an Aussie citizen. He found all his comets from Australia, of course. I met him on one occasion. He's a very nice chap. He died earlier this year, so it's a great loss to comet astronomy.
Now, I know that you've visited some of the greatest observatories in the world. Do you have any particular favourites?
I love Mauna Kea. It's a great observatory to go to. I've been up there a couple of times now, and I was up there halfway up the mountain to observe the comet Hale-Bopp in 1997. And that was actually a spectacular place to observe it from, and a dead clear sky, and the comet, of course, was just a super spectacular, but the sky in general, it was just wall-to-wall stars. Because from that latitude, you could see quite well south, and I could see the Southern Cross when I could identify it amongst all the stars, finally. It stands out here, but amongst the stars up there, it's just such a black sky. There's everything. There's a whole place is a blaze of light.
Yeah, I have to admit... Go on, Neil.
Oh, sorry. I was just wanting to ask Rodney's opinion. If you were starting out comet hunting today, Rodney, so you've got your first scope and you want to do it, how would you go about doing it now that we have sky surveys like Catalina, Mount Lemmon, and of course, Anstars, which basically nearly every single comet is named after now because they just pick them up, don't they? They sweep them up like a Hoover. How would you now go about doing your searches?
Well, to be brutally honest, I wouldn't. Visual comet hunting is essentially a dead duck now. Even the amateurs are using patrol cameras, and some of them are remotely controlled. It's a group of Russians, I believe, who operate one in Australia by remote control.
That's Ozon, yeah.
You simply can't compete with that sort of technology doing it visually. In fact, I think the last visual comet discovery would have been IKEA's last one. It was Akira Murakami back about 5 years ago. I think that was the last actual visual, true visual discovery. But the time I found my last comet, that was the, the 29th comet found that year. It was actually the last comet of the 1980s, but it was the 29th comet of the year. But now you're getting something 200-300 comets a year. And they're all found by remote control and by the deep survey. So the visual comet hunting is just a dead duck. So it's a sort of exercise in futility, I suppose. But you get to see the sky in ways that people just don't. You see more of the sky than any other astronomer, I think.
Patrick Moore once commented that the best way to discover something is to learn the constellations and be able to star hop rather than use GoTo. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm not a great person for memorising things. I've got a rotten memory for some things, and so I simply compare what I see with what I see on a chart and vice versa. If you can do that, you can find anything if it's there. And I purely work that way. If I found something, I would then go to my charts. And of course, eventually, you get to know sort of favourite objects, and you think, oh, that's that thing again. And one or two unfavourite objects, too. There's a couple of southern galaxies, which I absolutely hate because they looked exactly like comets with small tails. And the fact that they lie with the tail, as it were, pointing straight up. That's IC-55, and let's see, it was the NGC... Oh, I've forgotten the number of it now. But anyway, there's a couple... IC-55 is one of them, yeah. But anyway, they look exactly like comets, and the number of times I've discovered those, yes, oh, that thing again.
Yes. I've discovered Messier-31 on many occasions, I must admit.
I once discovered the 47 Tucani in bright twilight and kicked myself a bit over that. I didn't report it, luckily.
what star
have you,
charts...
Have you...
Sorry, Neil.
Sorry, Nick, you carry on.
Okay, I was going to ask... Yeah, go on, Neil.
Okay, sorry. I was just going to ask you, Rodney, have you been outside recently to look at any of the
current ones?
Skies, which I think you've got Catalina at the moment, haven't you? And... yeah, the current month, yeah, Pan-Stars Q1 you've got on your skies right now too?
I haven't been out, no, I have to admit I have not been out observing of recent times. It's a while since I did anything serious. We've got a few other priorities on the plate at the moment. And of course, one of the Pan-Stars which came up in the evening sky rather nicely about a month ago, I never got to see because it was always cloudy in that part of the sky at that time of the night. And by the time it cleared off, the comet had set, so I didn't get to see it at all. That's the only one I've actually tried to find. I think the last one I saw was one of Terry Lovejoy's and I got it in bright twilight, but with a pair of binoculars. But I haven't
still visible in that sky. It's still visible in that sky. It's about 8 months later. Yeah.
Oh yes, yes. I saw. I look at pictures on the net, and I think, oh, here we go. Still going. Yeah.
Quick question for you, Rodney. If you're an observer in the southern hemisphere, what charts would you recommend for somebody who wants to look visually?
I use the let me see. I've got several charts I use. The first to find exactly where I'm looking, or roughly where I'm looking, you know, it would be the Norton Star Atlas, a good old traditional. Or the Vectra Atlas of the sky. I also have a copy of the Canterbury Sky Survey, which is a southern extension of the Lix Photographic Survey. And the Canterbury Sky Survey was photographed at Mount John, and there were only 75 copies that were printed, and I got one of those copies. So that takes down to about 13th magnitude or thereabouts. But that's true photos. And I also use, now let me see, what is it? I can't remember the name of the chart now. It's silly of me. memories go. It shows how long I've been out of business. I've got it around somewhere. I'm sitting in my library. I'm surrounded by books and charts and gosh knows what else. And I can't remember the name of it. But there are many chart systems around. What you need is something that shows galaxies and clusters, particularly, say, down to 13th, 14th magnitude. If you've got something available like that, then you're competing, I suppose, in the sense that you can see anything which is defined as a bright comet. Faint comets, of course, well, they're going down fainter than 14th magnitude, and it gets quite a job to identify anything. Because it's just every time you go down one magnitude, you double the number of galaxies you see, and galaxies and comets look exactly the same, except the comets move. Yeah, that's tricky. There are so many chart systems around now that some better than others. But ones based on photographic images are really the best ones to work with, I think. Well, some of the, even the planetarium programs you get for a computer are really excellent because they show everything. Things like the sky is one of the ones I use for some of my more in-depth work.
Which version of the sky? So, curiosity.
I've got a copy of the Sky Pro, which is pretty, it's not cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually been using their online system, the Sky Live, and I have to admit, for actually putting a telescope dead centre on a comet, it's brilliant. Particularly if you're doing follow up or you just want an image on the for your collection. But yeah, the Sky is very, very good, and it's one of the ones I recommend. I also use Starry Nights. I got the Pro Plus 6 version, and that definitely does give you all the information you need. And of course, if you're using a modern telescope with GoTo, it can also help you avoid the fainter galaxies.
Well, we've just set up a new telescope at the New Plymouth Observatory. We've got a 14-inch Celestron on a Paramount MX, and we're just getting it going. We were trialling it out the other night, and it's impressive. We're right on the Sky Pro, and just dial in where you want to go, and the telescope goes there. That's absolute luxury compared with anything I've ever used, either amateur or professional, when I worked at Mount John, when none of our gear worked that accurately.
Now, you talk about doing photometric work on comets. Could you explain some more about that, please?
I have done some sort of trial photometric work again, but was when I was at Mount John. And it was a case of single channel photometry using a large aperture, so you're measuring your comet immediate sort of central condensation and a large aperture, and you measure the sky and comparison stars and so on. But it's rather difficult because you're comparing a fuzzy object which has quite its own distinct profile and light across the across the comet here, and comparing that with brightness of stars. So it's subject to quite a lot of systematic errors that you have to take out. The data reduction is more difficult. And then, of course, comets, as say, they're a mixture of gas and dust, so a dusty comet will give you a completely different sort of problems to, say, a gassy comet. The gassy comets, of course, are emission spectrum, so you've got to have filters that look at the right at the right wavelengths or cover the right wavelengths, so that it gets a bit tricky. Most of the work I did with photometry is... it was pretty hairy, actually. I don't think I ever got any really reliable information out of it.
What would you say your greatest comet you've seen in your time as an astronomer
the greatest
is?
The greatest by far, and in terms of spectacle, was Hale Bopp. The most beautiful one I ever saw was Comet McNaught, 2006. But the best by far was 1982 M1, the very first one I discovered. You can only ever find your first comet once.
That's very true.
Now,
that was mind-boggling.
Now, I know that you actually got invited to the Minor Planet Conference at the University of Arizona back in 79 because of the photoelectric observations of minor planets and comets. What was that like?
Terrifying. I found myself surrounded by a large number of people who knew infinitely more about the subject than I ever will, and I had to give a poster paper about what I was doing, and that was absolutely terrifying. But they treated me very nicely, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself there. Really.
Now I know that that you actually met up with David Levy at some point. What was that like? That was 2006.
No, that was prior. That was when I found my last comet. I got invited to Arizona to talk to a science fair, sort of a state science fair system. So that's how I actually met David, because he actually organised that. He rang me. I did actually tell him, the first person that invited me to go, that I wasn't able to go, I couldn't afford it, so on. The next thing I know, I got a phone call from David Levy, who really knows how to twist a guy's arm. And so I met him as a result of that, and we've been good friends ever since.
And then, of course,
very nice fellow.
You saw him again in Plymouth back in 2006 with his wife, Wendy, as well.
Yes. Well, yes, in 2006 they came out here to New Zealand, and I got them invited to the national conference, which we put on here in New Plymouth. And he was one of the guest speakers, and that went down a treat too, I tell you. It was great to be able to share in my part of the world.
Yep. So one of the things I actually do plan to do, and I know that Neil's slightly envious of this, that when I get back to the States from next year onwards, is that I will have the chance at last to actually go to David's comet camp in the New York's Adirondack. So I am really looking forward to that. It's supposed to be quite an interesting session, solid comet astronomy over a weekend.
Have you met David?
Not yet, no. That's why I'm looking forward to the whole thing, because I know...
No, he's a very nice fellow. He's full of enthusiasm, absolutely full of enthusiasm.
Neil?
He spends a lot of time with... I was going to say, David H. Levy tends to spend a lot of time reciting Shakespeare and things like that, doesn't he? More than comets, I'm told.
he did his degree in studies of Shakespeare at the poetry and so on of astronomy and Shakespeare. Yes, so he's got a very wide ranging knowledge of all manner of funny things, actually.
Back to you, Nick.
Oh, I should say over to you, Neil, because we have a few questions that we like to ask our comet guests, and Neil, I think you've got the 10 questions we like to ask, don't you, to hand?
I will have them in a second, Nick. Yes. I'll tell you what, because we covered the where you look sort of thing, haven't we? So I'll tell you what, do you ever listen to music, Rodney, whilst hunting back in those days?
I don't listen to music when I'm observing. No, I find it a total distraction. Mind you, you get other distractions as well when you're observing out in the wide countryside. The local cows would come along to see what I was doing, and we have our native bird, the kiwi, one of my observing sites. We had kiwis living nearby, and you could actually hear them calling because they're a nocturnal bird. We have the occasional idiot turn up with a car and their lights and so on, and people who get themselves lost in the middle of the night wondering where they are, and they stop for directions and wonder what the dickens I'm doing standing beside the road with a telescope. but I don't listen to music, no, not what I'm observing.
Well, we covered your favourite software and charts.
Yes.
Is there any particular... I was trying to think. Is there any particular instrument you would like to use for comet observations or hunting?
That's a tricky one. I wouldn't mind getting my hands on a decent-sized Schmidt. I saw the 48-inch Schmidt at Palomar one time, and I thought, what could I do with that? But other than that, no, not in particular. I think the instruments I've got work quite well. I'm in the middle of building a 16-inch specifically. It was designed specifically for comet hunting, but that project's been going on now for more than 9 years, and it's still not totally operating. But it'll work pretty well when I do finally get it going. But then, of course, I've sort of missed the boat where it comes to probably finding anything with it. But actual observations of known comets, so it'll be good for that.
And I know I've got the Neil's. Let me have a look at the picture. This is quite an interesting looking job. It's a handle. I thought it was a serial port for a minute. so you're burning a Dobsonian. Is there any preference for Dobbs over Newtonian?
Mainly convenience of mounting and storage. If you've got an equatorial mounting, it does have some advantages for some types of work, but if you're doing photographic work, but it just takes an awful lot of space. Whereas the Dobsonian is much easier to use. Right there in the field, you can set it up. It's actually designed to come completely to pieces, into seven pieces, and fit in the back of my little car, and then I can reassemble it on site. But these days, I don't go right out into the wide countryside. My wife gets a bit anxious if I do things like that. So it's going to be mounted in the end on a trolley, which I'll tow out into the backyard area and so on. Actually, we're in the process of putting our house on the market and moving somewhere else. I'm hoping that it'll have a yard where I can actually set it up in a more permanent sort of setting to do comet hunting or comet observations in general. And I'm also going to get into photographic imaging with a DSLR, and who knows, maybe do some photometry that way, sort of imaging photometry of comets and minor planets. So I've still got a few plans ahead of ways to spend my time.
That sounds really. I must admit that Dob really looks fascinating. Any plans to motorise it, or are you just going to keep it as a manual move?
It's going to be a manual drive. Actually, what doesn't show on that is that one of the clever ideas I have for scanning in azimuth, I got the idea from watching somebody in a wheelchair. If you see when I do a spin on a wheelchair rapidly and go off in a different direction. So what I've got is a very large unicycle wheel, which is going to be mounted on the side. And by driving the unicycle wheel, it will drive the telescope in azimuth. And I'll be able to get sort of very fine control in azimuth for scanning. I actually have the wheel. It's about 3.5 feet in diameter. And so it's going to look a rather weird-looking instrument by the time it's actually completed.
Now, what was the instrument you actually started off with initially?
The very first telescope I did any comet hunting with was a little spotting scope, like a rifle range scope. I went from that to a large pair of binoculars, and from that I then got the Jager's lens and built my 6-inch F8 refractor. So that's what I found the first comet with, and then the second comet was found with the the second version of it, the folded optical system with the 6-inch lens. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was the most successful telescope I ever had because although it was very, very heavy to lift around, I actually finished it on a Sunday and then the weather packed up and I got to observe with it on the Thursday night until the weather packed up, and then on the following Saturday night, less than a week after I completed it, I found the second comet.
Nice.
I was just wondering, Rodney, how long... Oh, sorry, I was going to say, how long was it between hour, you know, hour-wise that you found comets? I mean, every clear night, did you look for comets, or, you know, was it sort of like you have a break of a couple of 3 months?
Well, I'm a fairly lazy sort of individual, so I've actually spent, the three comets, I've spent 343 hours of actual observing time, but that's been spread over a number of years. So that... something like about 15 years to find the first comet, about 151 hours of observing in 15 years. So it's not very much observing time, really. So I'm basically, I'm just extraordinarily lucky.
One quick question I'd like to ask you is, when we put up the show notes for this show, may we use the photographs that you sent Neil? Would that be okay?
By all means.
Okay,
thank you. Yeah, sure. No problem.
Great. Neil, you got any more questions for Rodney?
Yeah, I have. There's two really. There's one is, what do you actually think of the sky surveys? I know we talked earlier on about Pan-STARRS because they do find basically everything. I know there's a few others, but do you think it's good that they find everything? You know, has it taken a bit of fun out the hobby? That, you know, I mean, I know Terry Lovejoy has a bit of luck, but do you think the romance is dead now? We live in the modern age.
After a point, I suppose that's true. But there's always a chance that something will turn up out of the blue. And take my second comet, for example. It was at its closest to Earth when I found it. It was just barely visible to the naked eye, and it was going like a bat out of hell. It was doing something like about 12, 13 degrees a day. It just came out of nowhere, whipped past it, and was gone. Now, there's no way that a big survey is going to pick that up and get it reported before somebody's going to find it. So there's always a chance. It may be a very small chance these days, but there's that chance there. So it hasn't totally killed what people, amateurs, can do. And I don't think it's really removed the romance. It's just a beautiful universe out there. And just get the chance to go out and enjoy it.
Finally, I'd just love to ask your opinion on the Rosetta thing with Comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko. What you think of the Rosetta mission?
Oh, yes. It's an interesting beast. I'm beginning to wonder, in fact, that when it does split, which bit's going to be called Gerasimenko and which bit's going to be Churyumov.
Good point.
Question for you. What's your favourite beverage when you're observing? And I know a lot of people say, don't drink tea and coffee, too much caffeine, you get the jitters at the scope. But what do you like to drink when you're at the scope?
I'll always take coffee out with me. I like coffee.
You like coffee. You're a coffee man.
I'm a coffee man.
Me too. Good choice. Right,
mind you, it can have its disadvantages. I found one time on Mount John. It can get awfully cold, and cold weather does have its effects. It can break the observing pattern.
Right. Do you have any more questions, Neil?
I think we've exhausted everything, haven't we?
Well, I just want to thank you very much for joining us, Rodney. What we'd like to do is, we do like to send you a copy of the show. So if you want to contact Neil offline, then we can try and get you a copy of the sound file over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I hope I didn't make too much of a fool of myself.
It's great having... The nice thing about having the experienced observers like yourself on is that everybody can learn something. We had Terry Lovejoy on. Terry spoke to us about how he did things and everything, and everybody who's been an observer or imager has done the same. And no, you haven't made a fool of yourself. It's always great to get somebody else's opinion, because everybody has a different way of doing things.
Yeah. Well, it's a great honour to have. Yeah, it's a great honour to have a comet discoverer talk to us about the way you did things. I mean, you did your thing in the early 80s. I mean, a lot of the people who are listening to this right now weren't even born then, so, you know, it's a great insight into the past for all of us newer people, you know.
Makes me feel really old.
Sorry.
No, I didn't mean it like that. Didn't mean it like that.
Yes, well, so it hits me occasionally. Oh, gosh, I'm 70. I've been in the game a long time. Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, Rodney, one quick question, one very quick question. Have you ever thought about writing a book about your time at the telescope?
Yes, I even started it. I got 2.5 chapters done, and I don't know what happened to them. But as I say, I'm rather lazy. But it's one of those things I should actually do, I suppose, and my own particular style of writing. It's, whether anybody would learn anything from it or just simply get a bit of entertainment out of it or something else.
Well, I think it would be interesting because it's having somebody else's point of view and having it as a reference. I know that Alan Hale did that recently himself, and I know Patrick mm-hmm. Moore's done that, and quite a few actually sit down and at some point write down their time at the telescope. But it does, in some respects, it does teach a lot because it exposes people to an alternative way to do something, particularly in the pre-CCD, in the observatory time. I can remember when it was all film, and when we used to go around and bathe our films in chemicals and pray that we hadn't done it for too long. And
well, I'm actually a photographer by training. I was an Air Force photographer before I went to Mount John. It's funny, the other day I dug out an old camera that I'd made that was going to be used for getting cast. In fact, it was used at that stage. It's still a 120 roll film back. And believe me, it hadn't been used for literally since about 1968. And I found a film in it. It's still there. So I got no way of processing it, so I just chuck it out. It would be long gone by now.
Oh, you never know that they're funny. They've been developing films that people have had stuck in their drawers for ages, and there's still images there, so it may well be worth getting it developed.
Mm. Well, I shouldn't think now, it's been well exposed now. But it was rather strange. I thought the film back was actually empty just a couple of days ago. So it's funny what you find when you're mm-hmm. checking stuff out. And to find, I've got some bits of gear that I've got to find another home for. I've got them on sale, but try to get some of the local people involved. But wasn't all that much interest.
Well, I just want to say thank you very much for joining us. I know that time zones tends to make life difficult, particularly for people like me and Neil. I'm relocating shortly myself, so I'm going to be in a completely different time zone to him. But I also want to thanks for coming on, Rodney. It's been really great having you here. And we hope to have you back in the future. Would you be willing to come back?
I would be interested, yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So I'm just going to say...
Thank you.
It's time to say goodnight, and good morning, depending on where you're listening to us, because the show goes out...
I'm 7 minutes short of morning.
7 minutes short of the morning. I'm just easing into the afternoon.
It's very late, but it'll be very early soon.
So I'm going to say it's good night from me.
And it's good night from me too.
And a good afternoon to you guys.
Good night, everybody. And good afternoon.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts. AFM.